I just put this up for a data moment. I thought you might enjoy this. I can't explain it. But it exists. There are photographs of it. If you Google the Watkin Tyler Country Park, there are photographs of it on the internet. It's real. It's near Basildon. And the thing about it is, if you look through the website for the Wat Tyler Country Park, you'll find out all about habitats for birds and places where people can sit and have a nice day out. But you won't find out a damn thing about Wat Tyler. It doesn't explain who he was or why he's got a park named after him. It's just one of the more bizarre kind of asides in English history, isn't it? Really. Obviously, we'll never forget him now. Because we've got a park we can go to.
You were saying that in Anglo-Saxon England, that apparently everyone had the vote, did they? Is that right, to elect to the...
Apparently all men had the vote. I'm not saying...
All men had the vote, yes. To the, what was it, the... What did they call their parliament? The Witan, was it?
Yeah, the Witangament.
The Witang...
I may have not pronounced that entirely correctly.
I vaguely heard about it. And then you were saying that, what was it, Henry VI did away with the rights, was it Henry VI or Henry II, did you say?
The Sixth.
Henry VI. That would have been during the Wars of the Roses, then?
It would, wouldn't it, yeah.
But why did he suddenly do away with...
I can't answer for the deeds of medieval, early modern monarchs. I don't know. All I'm doing...
No, sorry, I just wondered why...
I'm a historian of 18th century England. I know what they think.
I've studied history, for many years, and that's very interesting. I've never realised that, in Anglo-Saxon England, that every man, had the...
No, I'm not telling you that they did.
Oh, yeah, but as you understand they did, yeah.
Not even my understanding that they did. I'm just telling you that 18th century English radicals had it in mind that there's this Anglo-Saxon golden age of equal rights and equality for all, and it's something we have to recover. That was a myth that was very, very important to them.
Oh, I see. They weren't sure of it, then.
They weren't very sure of it.
What does it say in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles? Is there anything in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles about,
I don't know.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Check it, see what it says.
But, that is interesting, isn't it, that here we are tonight talking about, the rights of Englishmen, and yet it's interesting that in Anglo-Saxon England, it could well be that, that the ordinary man had more rights to vote, to vote into their parliament, up until we had, what was it, one man, one vote in 1918?
Yeah, but that's exactly what the radical discourse is about.
I see,
you that that's the case. And you now feel suitably annoyed, angry and aggravated that you've had various things, stripped rights that you should be yours, stripped away from you by usurpations and tyrants over the last 200 years, and you're now angry enough to fight back and demand concessions from the Queen, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, to me, as far as I'm concerned, we've got one person, one vote, and we've achieved it.
All right, you can sit back and relax.
Well, let's go on for that.
The Anglo-Saxon mythology was that King Alfred gave us, amongst many other things, the right to jury trials.
That's right, yes, I've heard of that.
Which Labour minister was it a few years ago who tried to get rid of those? Yeah. It had to be a bloody Labour government. It had to wait for a Labour government to come in before the jury trials are ratified. Because it clogs up the bureaucracy of the magistrates' courts. But that was, if you remember, there was quite an outcry about Jack Straw's aside. The Democrats should do away with his jury trials.
Absolutely very complex, high finance trial.
But there was one of those kind of libertarian outcries.
Wouldn't it be right to say that the British state will will remove those rights according to the situation it's in. They're not. Because I'm told the law is above everybody. The law is above everybody. It's on it. You know, it stands there. It's in stone. It's part of his liberties. But the moment there's any kind of threat to the British state, then those things disappear. So that, I mean, I wouldn't agree that, you know, that is okay. I mean, you're talking about martial law.
You understand that in Northern Ireland, if you thought that you stood in court gay liberty, and as soon as you stood outside, you were going to get fucked up, I mean...
I don't think that's why. I think they were worried that the juries might be pro-Republican. That's one of the problems, like...
Well
because 47...
The main thing was the danger of the witnesses, that anyone who's going to go along and give evidence, you know?
I think that's what they might have said.
But because of the threats to the juries. The stated reason.
That's the stated reason.
Was threats to the juries and jury members.
Oh, the jury, not the jury members. I got the witnesses as well.
That was their excuse. I mean, whether
that's really the reason is another question.
That was the stated reason.
Well, I don't know. I mean, if I was there and I'm
sure. I mean, they wouldn't say in that case that, you know, they're not going to say in that situation, well, we're going to remove the rights of juries because we're worried they might come to the wrong decisions. Are they?
Yeah.
They might not say
yeah.
Anyway, next question.
He's a point. I'm kind of toying a bit about it. Swift, I know, my limbs aren't starting to leave history, is that it wasn't that we had vote or constitution or any of that in this golden age of Anglo-Saxon history, but with the Whitlam stuff, you didn't get a vote, but there was a kind of a tacit understanding between the king and the feudal system, the people, the aristocracy, there was a kind of a custom. And that any kind of king that really went against that generally was removed. So it's very different. The British tradition of kingship is wouldn't even call it quite constitutional. It's different from the continental one, which was an absolutist one.
Oh yeah. So after 1688.
Oh no, before. Well, before, definitely before.
You did lots
of people before. Well, I mean, look, they removed them with oil.
Yeah, but
they were the roses.
Yeah, but they weren't technically speaking, before 1688, they weren't technically speaking there by contract.
Oh, No, I wouldn't say they were constitutional. What I'm saying is that it was by custom and written. Yeah. I mean, what was constitutional? Wasn't there anything that's kind of there with that? What it was there was kind of a custom, and you could see that in the peasant form of the Black Death. You get this idea that. They have rights and responsibilities, and it's unspoken. But if a king went against it and went for an absolutist rule, he knew that he shouldn't have done that because he's generally removed. Half of the argument about the Anglo-Saxon constitution, so-called, was, I mean, no one ever tried to produce it as a written form. No one argued that it had a written form. It was a customary constitution. It's a constitution of the mind, and it's held together by custom and practice and voluntarism. But it's still held. You know, that was the understanding amongst radicals. But it's we're dealing in realms of far-flung myth most of the time.
I'm not going for the constitution. What I'm saying is that not as a broad political settlement, but when you have individual disputes within a feudal custom with wage setting of Black Death and peasant folk, is that there was always this idea that no, this is how we did it before, and so we know you will not have that.
Right.
That's as far as I'm going with it. Not this overweening, non-historically based. On their proportion, if
you know, the most recent attempt to recover the Anglo-Saxon constitution was made in Parliament last summer.
Was it?
By David Davis. Was it? Well, is it? Well, we come to a pretty time, haven't we? When we have the shadow Tory Home Secretaries. Resigning on points of principle over the Anglo-Saxon constitution. That's what he said. The quote, as I remember from his resignation speech in Parliament, was that For 875 years, we have had these rights. But, you know, I mean, though he read it straight out of Obadiah Holmes or somewhere like that, you know. And it's a bloody Labour government, isn't it? Held up as the demons who are trying to remove these rights from us.
But, yeah, he became the hero.
Well, they reckon it's going to fail now, this 42, isn't it? Because perhaps the Lord has thrown it out, and now it's all kind of, you know, put to one side, isn't it? So presumably, was, you know, it's still 28. So, you know, that's a knock in the.
The radicals of the 1790s were operating in some ways quite a sort of comparable political climate, weren't they? Because that's, you know, it was this, just as you had prime ministers today saying, well, you know, we need these 42 days, or we need to just kind of suspend habeas corpus here and there because it helped, you know, it helped, because we're in a time of great crisis. That's exactly what Prime Minister Pitt was arguing in the 1790s when they were doing exactly the same things, curtailing the right to free speech, the right to free assembly, on the grounds that, well, look, you know, we're about to be invaded by the French and they're going to slit all our throats.
How did they curtail it? What mechanisms are they using to curtail?
Well, they passed, well, various means, by sedition trials in the first part, so people were being encouraged to inform a magistrate if they heard somebody in a pub say something like, oh, bugger of the king, I've had enough of this. You know, that would be enough to get you 2 years if you were unlucky. So there was just seditious speech was very prosecutable. They put John Thelwall and John Baxter, the great historian, and various other members of the London Corresponding Society on trial for treason in 1794, rather mistakenly, because the jury acquitted them, of course, and again, hurrah for English jurists, you know, another Anglo-Saxon liberty comes home to roost. But they were that didn't work out because it was hard for a court to argue, actually, hard for the state to argue, that the activities of the London Corresponding Society in petitioning for universal manhood suffrage were really likely to be construed as endangering the king, which is what treason, of course, has to do. So that failed. But most pointedly, after the king's coach was attacked by a crowd in 1795 on its way to Parliament, Pitt managed to push through two gagging acts through Parliament in the winter of 1795, early 1796. The Seditious Meetings Act, which was, it was passed, it forbade gatherings of more than 49 persons without a magistrate's licence were they to speak of politics. So you had to get, of course, the magistrate was simply going to say no. So basically, the London Corresponding Society could no longer meet in groups of more than 49. So that's a curtailment of your right to free speech and to public assembly. And then the other one, funny one was, I think it was the same year, 1796, they always had this Disorderly Houses Act, the Disorderly Houses Act was passed in the 1750s in order to deal with brothels, that's basically, and houses of ill repute, night cellars. And in 1796, they extended the meaning of the Disorderly House to one in which a political debate might be taking place. And it was aimed specifically at John Thelwall, who was doing lecture series in London every, you know, two or three times a week. He was lecturing on politics and reform in hired rooms in both the buildings just off the Strand and attracting crowds of 500-600 Londoners paying sixpence each to come in. Under the Disorderly Houses Act, that could now be described as a disorderly house because Pitt had basically said that politics would no longer be discussed in public, in an open forum, in public places. It was done under the same old excuse that we hear today, that we're in difficult, difficult times and the state is endangered and we cannot have people speaking sedition in public places.
I think just one thing. This afternoon we had an opening the archive session which Dawn in the Central Reference Library helped organise, and one of the things I was reading about, which I'm sure we've done some talks on this before, but in this context of repression, was the Despard, you know, Colonel Despard trials. And it is quite incredible to read the level of violence that the state was willing to, you know, I mean it's 1803, and I think he's the last group of people to be, you know, to be found guilty, and then you know, the sentences to be hung, drawn and quartered. Right, and this is described, you know, I mean, obviously we went through this the other day with Jeffrey Robertson, but on Monday night, the 100-odd quarter, you know, you get hung, you know, then you get tied down, they cut your bowels out and burn them in front of you while you're still alive, and get dragged down for a mile along the ground on the back behind the carriage, and eventually get chopped in four bits. And, you know, this is 1803. Let's have a think about this. Like, this is the level of violence they're actually going to unleash on somebody who hasn't actually done an insurrection. Right? Hasn't actually done it. They've just conspired to do it. So this is a conspiracy trial which ends up with people being hung, drawn and quartered. Now, they didn't actually follow the sentence through because I think they were worried about the reactions of the crowds. I don't know. But they didn't. But that was the sense, you know, this is fairly modern. You know, I mean, you expect that kind of stuff, you know, with like crazy monarchs and stuff, but, you know, or, you know, the level of sort of violence that monarchs would unleash on the population. But, so that's the kind of level of violence the state is willing to, you know, unleash on people who haven't actually done anything, technically.
Well, you're understating, in fact, because Despard was executed in that manner, but yet they rescinded the really gory bit.
Yes,
they hanged him and then cut his head off.
Right. Okay.
The tradition was to hold the head up, hold up the head and says, this is the head of Edward Marcus Despard, a traitor to his king and country. Everybody's supposed to go,
boom. Yeah. The crowd was silent, I believe.
The crowd was silent.
20,000 there?
Huge crowd.
Yeah.
But that was 1803, yeah. And it wasn't the last one. The last one was
Cato
Street.
Cato Street.
It was 1820.
Yeah, which again was pretty violent execution, yeah. Wasn't it? So, yeah. I know. I was kind of I always find that quite shocking, because I kind of think the 19th century is sort of, you know, modern or something. But it's not like something from the 12th
century. Do you know when execution for treason was stopped?
There's a few years
before. Tony Blair! 1998! See? People think he didn't do anything.
Well, I think that was probably because he was worried that when he stepped down, every more incoming government might look at the records going.
Yeah. Well, of course, you could just take them off to somewhere where they're extrajudicial, you know, to Guantanamo or something.
Do you know when they stopped stringing people up at the scene of their crime without the necessity of a nice trapdoor and the equipment, that kind of lynching? You know when the last one of those was?
What, how long ago? A lynching.
You would like to think so. 1841 was in Scotland, I found one. The last one in England was in 1830. At a time when the Bloody Code, so-called, you know, was being repealed back constantly. There were all sorts of attempts to repeal back the Bloody Code and to make it less violent, more humanitarian, or at least less kind of bloody, at any rate. So a lot of capital statutes were being repealed year in, year out. And then suddenly, 1830, they get three agricultural incendiarists who've just set fire to 50 quid's worth of corn and decide they must not only hang. I mean, in 1836, arson was repealed as a capital statute, so you couldn't be hanged anywhere after 1836 for arson. In 1830, they said, not only going to hang them, and the usual process was to put them on a trap door with a long drop and you died instantly because your neck broke. They said, where's the village where this took place? We'll set an example. And they were hanged in their village, in Somerset, of course. Which basically meant they were hanged by just being pushed off the back of a cart. And they dangle.
So it's like the kind of last phases of execution as a kind of terror.
Yeah, total terror.
When does it go inside the prison?
1868. But the norm in 1830, or the norm after about 1790 actually, was to hang people in public but on the top of the prison gates. So like, you know, you can still see the prison gates in Bristol, can't you, where they hang the Bristol four people they hanged at the end of the Bristol Uprising in 1831. The prison gates are still there. They used to hang them on the top. So they've kind of started to remove the body. They've got this sort of spectacle of the execution out of public reach, so you couldn't actually go right up to it anymore or stand and look just over the platform and watch them go down. You put it out of harm's way, you can't actually get at it. It's sort of distanced it a bit. So there's a process through which it's slowly taken away from public display. In 1868, it goes inside the prison, you don't see anything.
When was the last hanging from the Tyburn tree?
The Tyburn? Yeah. They stopped that in about 1780 and introduced the drop system outside Newgate, which is again supposed to be a bit more humanitarian.
Obviously, we need to do execution as the next thing, don't we? Okay, just put the front there for us.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could You keep talking about they were sort of harking back to this Anglo-Saxon golden age. Why exactly is that the era that they've picked? I mean, it's obviously like before the Norman conquest and sort of, so that's where all our nobles come from and around to them. But why have they not gone further back and talked about sort of pre-Roman? I mean, is it a lack of historical knowledge?
I think it's just a perception of who we are as Englishmen, isn't it? It's the free-born Englishman can't very well be a kind of a Celt or a Pict. They're from another fringe. The Celts are more sort of Irish than English, or Scots than English. And that's the popular perception. So if you're looking for the roots of Englishness, as I think they were, the English are the Angles and Saxons. It's that Anglo-Saxon.
Are they invaders as well?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. Well, you know, there are no.
Is that not
a perception? Yeah. Well, good question. I don't know.
Well, isn't it because the Anglo-Saxons are... Isn't it because the Anglo-Saxons are looked on as the founder of the English nation, isn't it?
Yes, they are.
I mean, I love to go to London, and, you know, you get people in London, they say, oh, we're London, you're from the provinces, you see, and then you give them a history of Anglo-Saxon, of Wessex, and Alfred the Great, you see, and I say, well, of course, Wessex was, you know, and Alfred the Great was the founder of the English nation, and he defeated the Danes, and from that he, you know, you've got the English nation. And I said, well, London was just some city in the east, you see. I said, that's where power was, you see, and they don't like it in London because they, you know, they all think they know it all. So that's a great, you know, bargaining chip, you know.
But the other point is an important one, I think, because he is reckoned to, you know, he'd understood to be the monarch who brought us juries and laws.
Yes.
He's the founder of our libertarian English constitutional tradition. So that's the myth. But it is all mythology.
So there's no fact that under Alfred the Great that you know that you had, you know, one man, one vote. That every man vote. It's all myth or
I think you'll find that's a
myth. Myth. But this is the Anglo. What about the
Anglo-Saxon?
You don't know that. You don't know whether it's in the Chronicles. No. I'll have to go and buy them. But yeah.
Right. I wanted to follow up on. Was it Thomas Spence or Spence?
Spence.
Well, you know, you say that was the avenue that wasn't explored. Why, could you say a bit more about why nobody sort of latched onto that as an idea? Because it sounds a much more radical.
It is a much, much, much more radical idea, but it's just based, I don't know, you know, why do you think? Why wouldn't you follow? I mean, it's impractical, wasn't it? There was a logic to the way that radicals organised. They had for centuries been petitioning Parliament and then remonstrating with their monarchs to interfere with Parliament and to get little gains along the way, with an aim, ultimately, of universal suffrage. The idea that, you know, if we got the vote, we would be free. The Chartists believed it, you know. that was the main aim of the... I mean, the Chartists had, of course, a land movement they developed in the 1840s after two attempts to get the national petition turned into law had failed. Then, of course, people start looking elsewhere and go, well, maybe we'll just go back to the land, you know. Thelmall went back to the land, came as a
farmer for
you. But wouldn't it be true to say the Chartists came much more out of an industrial setting, and maybe they were less attached to the land than people maybe at the time you're talking about here.
Yeah, in reality they are, but they have the same Arcadian dreams about land. But I mean, you know, I just think there's a given tradition that people easily fall into and follow because it seems to be going somewhere and it has a logic to it and it doesn't get you killed. It's not unconstitutional to petition Parliament for reform. Parliament can be reformed. Burke's argument about the Constitution was that, of course, it reformed itself all the time. That was the virtue of it. It just slowly improved. A great story of progressive improvement. And Spence just wants to go, right, actually, just start from scratch. Let's just take over the land. It's all very well saying you'll do that, but how are you going to do it? How will you start? No, it's impractical, isn't it? But it's not that Spence didn't have any followers. He did, and they're fascinating people. The Cato Street Conspirators, great example. They were Spencians. And they they have a whole little culture of their own, but they are marginal, really, in the English radical tradition. Fascinating and wonderful, but a bit marginal.
I think Arthur Thistlewood was the last person to be beheaded, wasn't he? My question actually was tapping back to the previous question about the Anglo-Saxons, and I wonder whether Robin Hood could usefully enter the fray, sort of between Alfred the Great and Wat Tyler, and he was very much sort of this melding together of loyalism and rebellion in one figure, and he was kind of a green man that was resurrected at the end of the 18th century by people like Ritson. I think he appears in The Relics of Ancient Poesy. Percy and Thomas Love Peacock a bit later. I don't know if he appears in any of the political writings of the period. I imagine he probably would do.
I don't know if in Champion, it's interesting.
It does appear in the Civil War.
And he's terribly important to this whole idea of the Norman yoke theory, history, of course. You know, So he sort of fits quite neatly with your sort of the Saxons as being, the Anglo-Saxons as being the Golden Age, you know, since the Age of Roman.
It's interesting that literary figures seem to have picked up on him, but maybe not so much the political writers or...
I don't know. He doesn't seem to play a very big role in 18th century popular politics. Actually, they're much more interested in Wat Tyler than they are in...
You mentioned, was it Fowler, that he sort of imagined that we had these natural rights before history?
Yeah.
Could you elaborate more on what sort of rights he envisioned and how he decided upon those, and then how he elaborated them to make them sort of relevant to his time?
Well, I think the way Thelwall sees it is he is trying to follow Paine in the idea that, you know, we as citizens we have rights, we have natural rights, they're the rights of humanity. No one ever really delineates very clearly exactly what those rights are, except when they're put into the Declaration of Rights, you know, in the French Revolution and so on. So they're kind of articulated by various people at various times. Thelwall never lists what they are precisely, but he agrees that natural rights are real, and they are the basis for constitutional government, for legitimate government. And he's just in this slight kind of confused state where he wants to go along with Paine and just say, look, you know, you don't, it's a question of enlightenment, logic and reason, you know, that only government which is based upon natural law and natural rights and a universal egalitarian principle, only that is reasonable. Nothing else is reasonable. The idea of kings is just not reasonable. You know, that you can be born a king and then expected to govern is just stupid. You know, how could anyone have made that up? And so he wants to go so far with that, but he's still fascinated by this idea that actually you can hold on to English history and say that all those English historical traditions, which are so powerful, so powerful in the English radical tradition over the centuries, are actually underpinned by the natural rights that Paine is telling us about. You know, so you can do it both ways. You can have your cake and eat it. You can have history and just keep reminding ourselves that all those historical beliefs are underpinned by natural rights theories. The Anglo-Saxons, he seems to imagine the Anglo-Saxon world as the first time, really, that a civil society, as he would call it, is created. It's
nonsense.
Because, I mean, if they couldn't really think of what the rights were, then how did they even try to build upon it? Like, how did it try?
Well, if you can read the Declaration of the Rights of Man as the French articulated them, or as the Americans articulated them, when there's a revolution and a constitutional document is produced, the rights of man are usually set out. You know, the right to food, clothing and shelter are basically the basic rights of man, aren't they? The right to political influence, the right to citizenship, the right to not, you know, the right to choose one's oppressors is a marvellous thing, and we all still adhere to. But you know, that, I mean, all rights theories are based on this kind of fundamental woolly notion, aren't they, of universal brotherhood, liberty, equality, fraternity. And then they have to be delineated and turned into law, and depending on where you are and in which country you live, those rights may be slightly different. We have rights under Magna Carta. Interestingly enough, as you spot the other day, that the rights of the forest were overturned in a court recently. What was that? Did you hear that? The forest charter was overturned recently in a court.
Really?
I can't remember why or where. That's right. It was the Forestry Commission, wasn't it? That's right, health and safety. We cannot have people just foraging around in our forest because a tree might fall on them.
It's not a practice.
Do you see the second feature for the Guardian today?
No.
Talking about the British Library, there's a British Library exhibition coming up about the Constitution, that actually has an extract from the Forest Charter.
Oh, does it?
A little picture.
Magna Carta's on permanent show, isn't it, in the British Library, if you pop in and have a look.
But there's got other documents going on. Yeah, there's an exhibition on the moment showing other key documents.
Oh, we should go,
But if you go to the site of where the Magna Carta was signed, what kind of memorial is there to recognise that very historical moment?
I was wondering that one in there.
Very wide, and it looks very American, you know?
Yes. Who was Monday out to do she dying phone?
Yeah. You need to talk to Peter Lyman about that.
Yeah. He actually shows us pictures of the.
Yeah, he had his photo. He went off and took photos.
Yeah, running the mess.
The running leaf volume.
Anybody else got a question?
Thurlow, isn't he the one that had lots of. Didn't he end up in Bath? The local connections.
He died in Bath. That's the only thing he ever did in Bath.
I wasn't.
He passed through and had a heart attack in the midst of a lecture to that. Well, he was in bed at night and that was, he died. So he's buried there. His grave is there to this day. We go and see it. We had it restored about 4 years ago, 2 years ago.
I've got a quick question. What interests me is, having done a lot of English Civil War work this week, involved in it, what confuses me is, you've got this, the Glorious Revolution and all that, but why is it, that seems to have dominated the political debate, whereas, what happened in the English Civil War, the English Revolution, it seems of lesser importance to these radicals. Is that true? That the English Civil War doesn't...
central to the debate.
Well, For a lot of them, what fascinates them about the English Revolution was that it caused the death of the king. Yeah. And that's constantly gone over and reiterated and used as a warning to monarchs. It's a great thing to dredge up as a warning, but they're not... Because the problem is that it produced Cromwell, ultimately. And that is a problem for radicals in the 1790s, who are a little bit iffy about Robespierre. Very iffy about Napoleon. So I suppose that's their main interest, I suppose, is that kings who will not be bound by the constitution will end up forcing the hand of Parliament to remove them, or the people will remove them. And that might be bloody and unpleasant, and it might cause all kinds of chaos as a result. But, that's the way it usually comes up.
I suppose it was really coming from the point of view that did anybody read, certainly the way I read the French Revolution and the English Civil War stroke revolution from your point of view is that I read it as situations where you could have had debates about constitutional or obviously division of power effectively, within a group of people in Parliament in the monarchy. But in fact what happened was is that it got pushed a lot further than they wanted it to go. Sure. So I certainly think the French Revolution is an example of that. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned 1792, because that's when the revolution actually started, in my opinion.
Yes.
And certainly in 1647-49, I believe that, that it was pressure from below that certainly played a part in the eventual demise of the king. It wasn't something that Cromwell necessarily came up with as a plan.
Oh, no, absolutely.
So I wonder whether the revolutionaries or the radicals, let's say, that's a better word, the radicals of 1798 had any sort of understanding of those processes at all. Or are they just looking purely from a kind of constitutional point of view?
Well, it is a constitutional point of view, isn't it? I mean, even in the 1640s, it's a constitutional
It's a constitutional issue, putting the king on trial is a constitutional issue. Otherwise, we were, I mean, there was never any attempt to just drag him off and string him up. He had to be put on trial.
Well, I would argue that, for example, that perhaps the new model army, people in the new model army wanted to get rid of him for a very simple reason. They didn't want to have to do any more fighting.
Yeah, sure.
So what I'm trying to say is that the pressure that came below, the pressure that comes through the new model army to seize the king,
yeah.
I think in 1647 comes out of the new model army. It doesn't come necessarily from the grandee.
No.
So I just wonder whether they're aware of that kind of stuff.
Well, I think they're aware of that sort of stuff, but I think it's just a different era. You know, there's, I mean, if you can look at the behaviour of English soldiers in the 1790s, who are, I mean, when they're abroad, they're fighting, that doesn't seem to be a particular problem, does it? But when they're at home and they're expected to be used for crowd control occasionally during times of scarcity during food riots, you find them to be occasionally recalcitrant, you know. But there's a refuse to take part. And in Devon, of course, they leave quite the time in 1795, and then again in 1800. And there are times where the military appear to be, you know, not entirely reliable in situations
fleet
like
mutants.
That. Sorry?
Fleet mutinies as well.
Yeah, oh, and fleet mutinies, absolutely, yeah. But there doesn't seem, you know, the fleet mutinies were, it wasn't that difficult in the end to stop them, was it? You know, it wasn't that difficult to overcome it. And everything goes back to normal within a few weeks. There's not a kind of a general feeling amongst the lower classes, I don't think, that the best thing to do would be to have the king done away with. There's sort of, you get talk, but not specific plans. And they would be looking towards the organisations, you know, the London Corresponding Society, the United Englishmen, the United Britons. Even United Englishmen, United Britons don't seem to be entirely sure that they want to establish a republic. It's not very clear from the text, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, could I follow up on that? I mean, not that I know much about your period, but I spent a while reading up about the Restoration period, but particularly I was interested in founding the Royal Society and various things. But in terms of the English Civil War period, I mean, it was never a simple picture. You know, there was not only Parliament, the Royalists, it was religious questions, there was the England, Scotland, Irish questions, there were all sorts of things with them. And a lot of people ended up moving around over this period of things changing over about 10 years. And what I was getting a sense of in the stuff that was going on in the 1660s, a lot of people wanted to forget all that had gone on, because almost everybody had something nasty to remember. You know, almost nobody had a sort of purity of one side they were on, and, you know, they were the angels. So I suspect that might be a good reason where people are starting to sort of open up that can of worms of thinking, well, we can't refer back to that because, okay, this side was doing something we liked, but 5 years later, really nasty things were going on. And also about 10% of the population died a really nasty, violent death.
In the civil wars are difficult.
Yeah. Well, at least they got the main criminal.
Don't fire.
Another question?
Well, I was just going to maybe make a suggestion on that comment that at the time wasn't about the civil war and chucking your king or your monarch out at that time. I think, did I hear earlier in the week that that was quite unique in Europe?
First in the world.
It was first, so like we were still kind of breaking ground then. No one had done it before, no one knew how to react. The whole concept, perhaps, of doing away with your monarch and ruling for yourself was perhaps mind-blowing. So no wonder they really bloody carefully.
It did make it a bit ironic, didn't it, that the British made a fuss about the death of Louis XVI after having pioneered the technique themselves a few years earlier.
Yes. Any other questions? Somebody asked about Tom Paine.
No, just comment. Sorry, did you want to finish?
No.
That's interesting about, you know, the English making a fuss about the death of Louis. But of course, I mean, with his case, he was just taken out and executed, wasn't he, you know? Whereas at least Charles I got a trial.
Louis XVI got a trial.
Did he?
Yeah.
But anyway, coming back to the Civil War, is that I'm a follower of the Sealed Knot, so, you know, you live in Durham going through this battle. Is that actually in the Parliament, and even in the parliamentary courses, there were very few who actually wanted to get rid of the king. The whole point of the Civil War was to bring the king to book so that he would rule with the parliament, which was then the will of the people, or a certain number of people, and that was it. And in the film Cromwell, and there's a lot of inaccuracy, but basically in the film Cromwell, Cromwell puts this agreement to the king and tries to get an agreement, and who was it, Lord Clarendon, you know, comes up to Cromwell and says, well, you know, he's not going to agree, he's going to go away and make out he's following it, and, you know, he's basically going to, you know, rip it up and throw it away, and that was it. And I think in the end that Cromwell and the leading parliamentarians just got, you know, just so fed up with it and thought, well, that's it, you know, we can't get an agreement, we can't get him to agree, you know, to rule with parliament, so that's it. We'll put him on trial, and I don't know whether they were actually going to execute him, but I suppose they thought, well, you know, that's the outcome, you know, and they put him on trial for crimes against the people of England.
Well, I actually dedicated Monday nights talk to Cornish Joyce, so I kind of disagree with you a little bit there, because it was actually, I'd argue, the New Model Army's decision to seize the king. The reason they did that was because Parliament was going to sell it to the Scots for £100,000, and they didn't want to fight another war. So the New Model Army itself is quite capable of making decisions, it seems, about. And if you think it was just Cornish Joyce, it's 500 New Model Army soldiers and Cornish Joyce that confronted the king on a doorstep outside a manor, remember it was, in Hampshire. And, well, I'm just going to tell a story because it's something about the moment, I would argue, in history where the British people first time confront a monarch on a doorstep. They turn up, the New Model Army decides to seize him because they don't want to fight another civil war. So they organise themselves, they elect Cornish Joyce, an ordinary soldier, to lead them, and they go down with 500 cavalry, and they get to a manor, and they knock on the door and say, Cornish Joyce knocks on the door and says, oh, you know, I want to talk to the king, because we're cool to you, you've done a round, oh my god, you know, you can't do that. And he says, I'll get the king to the door, the king has to come to the door, face an ordinary soldier who says, right, you're coming with us. Right. And the king says, where's your deposition from Parliament? And Cornet Joyce points over his shoulder at the 500 New Model Army soldiers are lined up and says, that's my deposition. And the king says, that is a very fine deposition. So that to me is an example of where British people for the first time confronted a monarch on an equal level. The monarch understood the relations of power. And that's a very, very important moment. So I would argue it wasn't just necessarily machinations amongst the group of parliamentarians or grandees in the army that confronted the monarchy over that period. It was actually often the actions of ordinary soldiers, and you can understand why. Their friends had died. You know, they'd been through the war, and they weren't going to do it again. And if that meant the execution of the king, then that was necessary. And I don't think that's necessarily what happened in the trial. I think it was actually a pretty fair trial. I think there was a lot of pressure from below to sort this problem out. And the problem was counter-revolution, that's what he wanted.
But if the king had accepted the agreement that Cromwell and the leading parliament had put to him, and he said, all right, okay, you know, we've won the war, I'll agree to work with parliament, then the war would have finished anyway. There wouldn't have been a second and third civil war, would there?
No, not at all. But the point about this is like all revolutions, it doesn't necessarily mean that the people who claim to have divine right are going to give up that power. I mean, you know, you're quite right. If the king had come to a deal, an arrangement, then it would have been a constitutional monarchy, right? Which is effectively what we got in the end. But if forces who want to retain their like absolute power over the population don't want to do that, then the situation could get pushed a lot further. And I think that's exactly what happened in, I mean, maybe Steve can correct me, but in 1789, I think the king, you know, continued to conspire in France to overthrow, you know, what happened, which is technically could have become an agreement. So, you know, things in history don't always work the way perhaps they should have done, or maybe they were for the better because the king didn't compromise.
It's true, isn't it? In the English context, in the 1790s and afterwards, you know, in that sort of, say, from the period from the Despard conspiracy, certainly, through to Cato Street, that sort of long 20-odd years, you know, there are every sort of insurrectionary plot or insurrectionary idea that gets off the ground, the first thing is that what people do, can we get soldiers on the other side? There are plenty of obvious attempts by radicals to turn the guards over, you know, so that the Tower of London could be turned over to the people, for example, and the armories could be raised. But of course, it never happens. You get five or six disgruntled guardsmen who sort of throw their lot in with the revolutionaries. But it never seems. You don't get the impression that there's a big groundswell of disgruntled soldiers just waiting to rise. They do rise occasionally, of course, when the prices are high. They want cheap bread, but it's not actually a sort of a political disaffection. I don't know how far we've gone from it, but I mean, it never actually
happened.
To lead on to what you said about the king conspiring, this was essential because obviously there's all these different sections between, you know, and that was part of the reason why the new model was set up, was because certain elements within the rounded army were considered not prosecuting the war to be too loyal to the king to want to actually finish the war. And the king conspired and was considered a traitor to his people, meant that even those parliamentary side who wanted to retain the king made their position indefensible and not being able to defend him. I mean, it also feeds into that idea that a lot of these kind of rebellions and stuff are always about separating the king from his bad advisors, and this is where the method form failed, because they thought they could come to an arrangement with Richard II, which was ridiculous. It was the king, it wasn't his advisors that are the problem.
Well, I think Steve talked last year, actually in May, wasn't it, about this kind of relationship between the people and the king and the contracts and all that.
You can buy my book.
What is the book?
The Politics of Regicide. It's called. It's fabulous. It's published by Manchester University Press, Richard, at £42.50. Unfortunately, I think you can get a cheap one on Amazon.
Right.
Almost certainly. There must be a remaindered copy. What?
We donate
a copy
to the library.
I would if I had any left. But all my freebies I gave away. It has been out for some time. It hasn't been pulped yet. It hasn't been remaindered, unfortunately. That would be the answer. If they'd be remaindered, they'd be cheaper, wouldn't they?
So that's apparently the moment where an author feels the worst, is where you walk into a shop and they're in the bargain bin. It's the work you've spent so many years.
Everybody's walked past it. Harry Potter.
Propping up the table was a...
Another speaker on Tuesday we had, who like finished his book, put it into publishing, and it printed and everything, and then pulped about 2 months later. Because he would take the court, the archaic libel laws in Britain, and had to mention something about Al Qaeda and a Saudi millionaire, and next thing you know, it was gone. Along with five other books that have been banned around that subject. So yeah, you were right, you've got a few knocking about. Right, one more quick, yeah, okay.
Can you tell me a bit about Thomas Paine?
No.
Well, we will be getting Rob Lowry, especially given the thought of Thomas Paine tonight. We'll be coming back.
He will be coming back
to talk to you. We can get up here and make
sense. But have you read The Rights of Man?
No, I haven't.
You must read The Rights of Man, it's brilliant. That's what I'll say about Tom.
Okay, you might have been a bit cold now. Just a bit cold. Need to go. Yeah, just good. See you. A round of applause.